We are continuing today with a new sermon series entitled A Witness of 6,000 Years, with this being part two, as was stated last Sabbath, a longer title that would more fully show what this series is all about. And that I mentioned last week, the title would be more appropriate, except title should be shorter, but a longer title that would explain it better is A Witness of 6,000 Years Reflected in 3.5 Years. That's what we're living through. That's what we're experiencing. That's what we began to experience toward the end of December of 2008 and continue to experience those things that God is giving a reflection of in 3.5 years, especially when you understand it about His mercy upon this world for 6,000 years. Anyway, big carrot there, but anyway, it's hard sometimes to catch those things. But anyway, I'll get to that later on. This sermon today is indeed about a witness of 6,000 years and how mankind has consistently responded to God during that period of time and as mankind does now. And now how that entire period of time is indeed being reflected as a witness in this final 3.5 years, because it is about a witness before Jesus Christ returns. So as we stated last Sabbath, I was reading from the posting entitled Time is Running Out, and I want to go back to that today, back up another paragraph just to bring us back into context. And again, this all in the context, or it was in the context of what it means to be a witness. That's what this sermon is about, what it means, how it's been used through time, what God is doing and why this is summed up in a 3.5 period of time, and why God puts special emphasis on those words so that we can grasp what has been taking place indeed for 6,000 years. So let's go back to that now. I'm going to go back to that and back up another paragraph here, and then we'll continue forward in that section about time is running out. It's not the latest posting because a new one went up this morning, and I'll get to that in a moment. But backing up here, talking about in the posting there, getting down and talking about how the World War II came about and looking in prophecy about World War III and what God said would come to pass. And this is a part of discussing that. History is repeating itself. However, this time, before World War III comes on the world scene, God has declared that the United States will collapse before she can be awakened. Yes, the United States is prophesied to collapse as a nation before she can be awakened and before World War III strikes the earth. That collapse is now at the doorstep, except for a very few whom God has chosen to call into His church. No one wants to listen to such pronouncements, except for those that God is drawing. No one believes them. Instead, the truth is ridiculed, ignored, slandered, and even mocked. Been that way for 6,000 years. And some of the prophecies we're going to go through, or some of the things written by the prophets, explain that very thing. So going on here in this article, that does not change what is fast approaching and what will happen. You know, just talking about World War III. I think I even have an article here if I brought it with me. Maybe I didn't today, but it is incredible what's going on in the world out there. Reading some of the things that has been happening recently. Yeah, let me... Oh, I thought I had those articles with me, but I don't see them. Anyway, more and more in Europe, we just don't get the news that's taking place over there in Europe unless you search for it. You have to go out and look for it. You have to look into other areas to find the news because it's not reported here in the United States. And when it is, it's very much watered down as to what's taking place. And last week, I don't know how many of you heard of Russia talking about how that the main general in Russia talking to the extent that they're being drawn into a nuclear war. That's what they say. That's what they believe. That's what they believe is taking place in Europe because of what's happening in NATO and some of the moving of missile defense systems supposedly against Iran. And they are saying if those things take place, they are definitely going to target some of those areas. That means war for them. And so depending on what stage the world is in and some of the saber rattling that sometimes takes place, but more and more people are starting to talk in those terms. And indeed, that's exactly what's going to come to pass. But going on. This time, as it's been stated, God is not going to allow the United States to be awakened as a nation. Only individuals can be awakened as they come to repentance for disobeying God. Remaining asleep is a result of the inability, or perhaps better said, the lack of will and leadership in government, business, and religion. So wherever you look, it's a choice that people make. And the reason for writing this and talking about what happened in World War II is that people felt that if you could put it at arm's length, that maybe it'll just all go away. Like I mentioned last week about Belgium and the Netherlands and some of the others who remained neutral for a time when World War II was already well underway and Germany was doing what it was doing, and they tried to remain neutral even after the UK and others began to talk about war and be involved in a war. They tried to remain neutral, and you think, it's coming your way. Just because you keep trying to push it aside and try to take a neutral ground doesn't mean you can stay there. It's incredible. A willingness to be asleep. Incredible. Same thing is true in business and in religion. You listen to the stock, people are talking about the stock market and the economy and so forth, and it's just not real to them what's coming. To a few it is. Anyway, going on. Therefore, a meaningful change in the course of direction is not going to be made. The truth is that due to selfish desire to retain power and hold to the ways of greed, change will not be made. Thought it'd be good at this point here to turn over to the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 1, because it's very much about what we're living through. And then we'll go back to this section here about time is running out. So much of Ezekiel has already been fulfilled concerning the church and concerning where we're headed, what's been taking place that we've lived through since 1994, the end of it. But in chapter 1, verse 1, it says, "Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kibar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. In the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity." Now, this is talking about a period of time around 592 BC. And it's going through here and talking about, as so many of these prophets do, about a period of time, more about Judah and their captivity and what took place when they were taken to Babylon. But interesting in the story here of Ezekiel, he begins to talk about the captivity of Israel. And Israel had long before gone captive anyway. They were already taken away captive. And people who read these things and discuss these things and supposed religious scholars go through this and don't grasp that it's talking about a future time for Israel, because they were already in captivity almost 200 years. And you think, well, they just don't understand. It's about this period of time that we're coming into, that we're now entering into. But it went on to say here, "The word of the Eternal came expressly unto Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kabar. And the hand of the Eternal was there upon him." So again, something that God began to reveal to him, that in turn was to be written down and recorded. And then jumping on down here in verse 28, it says, "As the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud in the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness round about." And so he's describing these things of angelic things that he's seen and so forth, and things that are appearing unto him in a physical way. He went on to say, "This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Eternal. And when I saw it, I fell upon my face, and I heard a voice of one who spoke." And then it goes on to say then in chapter 2, "And he said to me, Son of man, stand upon your feet, and I'll speak unto you. And the Spirit entered into me when he spoke unto me, and set me upon my feet, that I heard him who spoke unto me. And he said unto me, Son of man, I send you to the children of Israel." Now he is in captivity. They're talking about a time of captivity of Judah, at a time when they were taken captivity, talking about the period of time literally, because if you go back and study some of the kings, the last few kings and what happened there, they were taken captive by Babylon at different periods of time. There were some who were supposed to remain obedient to the king in Babylon and didn't, and we'll come to that later on in this series, perhaps today. But anyway, some were taken captive, many were killed and so forth, But a lot of people were taken at different waves into Babylon, into captivity. And this is what he's talking about, this period of time. But the message isn't to Judah. Judah was the one taken captive. It's the rest of the people, Israel. And that's what God is telling him. He's saying, Son of Man, I send you to the children of Israel. And so religious scholars read things like this, and to them it's a ridiculous thing because Israel was gone already, and they became known as the lost 10 tribes. They didn't even know where they were in history. You know? And awesome what we understand, what God has given to us. Send you to the children of Israel to a rebellious, it says here, nation or nations, as it is, it's plural, peoples, that have rebelled against me. They and their fathers have trespassed against me or transgressed against me, even unto this very day. So just the way they are. It continues on. And that which they had with them, they lost. They continued to lose because they carried with them something else, not God, not the truth about God, but what they began to do in Israel long before they were taken captive and the very reason for why they were taken captive. And that's what God is addressing and telling Ezekiel here. It goes on to say in verse 4, for they are impudent children and stiff-hearted. I do send you unto them, and you shall say unto them, thus says the Lord Eternal. You know, God's done this in different waves, at different times, to Judah, to Israel, and primarily to Israel during the time of Mr. Armstrong, candidly. And before that, there were different ones who went into that region. There are stories, things in history that I believe are true, very much so, about Peter going into the areas of Israel to speak to some of the people who were scattered in some of the other nations, and some others as well. Paul very possibly as well went into some of those areas. But incredible here, the response always is the same. Always the same. For thus says the Eternal God, and they, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear, for they are a rebellious house, yet shall know that there has been a prophet among them. Whenever they have gone, whenever God has sent different ones, especially in the Old Testament here in different times, and candidly, this is really about the end time. This is about the time we live in now. This is about this period of time exactly, because this is a primary period of time that God is focused upon in all the prophecies. It's about the end time and what would take place before His Son would come to this earth a second time. And so, jumping ahead, in chapter 3, again, part of the story flow here, in verse 4, it says, and he said unto me, Son of man, go, get you up into the house of Israel, and speak with them my words. Speak my words unto them. So it comes from God, but it doesn't matter who it is or who it's been through time. You say you're sent from God? Right. You know, people don't listen. They don't care. Especially today because of the freedom so-called of religion. But it doesn't matter when the period of time was. Jumping on down to verse 7. For the house of Israel will not listen unto you, for they will not listen unto me. So if someone doesn't listen to God, they're not going to listen to anyone sent from God. Even the story of Jesus Christ himself, God's own son. You know the parables that are even there that Jesus Christ gave. God sent his own son. And if they won't listen to his son either, obviously they're not going to listen to anyone else. So, and that's what the history of us 6,000 years, when God has talked to people, worked with people, except for those he specifically called that are recorded through history, they're the only ones who have listened. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted. People don't want God. They want to hold on to their ways. The human mind is so inward, so selfish. Unless God calls you out of that, which is a captivity, people don't have an ability to come out of it. But their choice by their reasoning is a different world, and it doesn't have to do with God at all. Going on, verse 8, behold, I have made your face strong against their faces and your forehead strong against their foreheads. Because of the hardness of heart in the world, and especially in Israel, and people who don't want God. That's basically how we have to live our lives. And kind of the expression that's like water off of a duck's back. That's how you have to deal with things. But this says something different as it goes on to show here. Notice, as an adamant harder than flint have I made your forehead. things are going to hit you head on. But I made your head harder yet in the sense of dealing with what they throw at you. Fear them not, neither be dismayed at their looks, though, it says, they be a rebellious house. Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, all my words that I shall speak unto you, receive in your heart and hear with your ears, and go, get you to them of the captivity, unto the children of your people, and speak unto them and tell them, thus says the Lord Eternal, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear. And it goes on. But the story is, all through prophecy, is that people never have wanted God. They don't choose God's way. And that's what we're living through now in the 3.5 years. People don't want to hear what's out there. People want to do their own thing and go their own way. And that's the way it's always been. And as it goes on to say down here in verse 15, then I came to them of the captivity at Tel Aviv, that dwelt by the river of Kibar. Now this is going back, and this is literally those who were in the captivity, speaking of Judah, who were from this region here, who were in captivity as well at this point. And I sat where they sat, and remained there astonished among them 7 days. And it came to pass, at the end of the 7 days, that the word of the Eternal came unto me, saying, Son of man, I have made you a watchman unto the house of Israel. And there's a lot said there that God has done through time about being a watchman, about a responsibility that God has given to those that he's given the truth to do a job, to understand the seriousness of it. And it's somewhat like a two-edged sword. I'll get to that in a moment. But going on here, it says, therefore, hear the word of my mouth and give them warning from me. So anyone whom God has called has a responsibility, indeed, to say what God has said, to stand up for what God has said, to live what God has said, and that's our life, all of us. And we learn very early on, when you're excited about what you've been given, the truth that God gives to you, and you try to share it with family members, loved ones, friends, close friends, you learn something so early on. They don't want it. They don't want what you have been given. But yet we have a responsibility to stand up for this way, to live this way, that they see this way, that we indeed make a difference when it comes to things like even what we eat or don't eat. It's not a matter of hiding from it. It's a matter of being out in the open about it so that they can see, yes, you are different. And why are you this way? We're talking about before services here about it. Some talking about it being Jewish holidays and so forth. No, they're God's, the Jewish Sabbath. No, it's not the Jews' Sabbath. It's God's Sabbath that he's given to us. And yet that's how so many people deal with various things. That's all they understand. But again, a watchman under the house of Israel. Therefore, hear the word of my mouth and give them warning from me. It's what Mr. Armstrong did over and over and over again as a watchman. And so through time, it's been that way. We've done the same thing within the church, spiritual Israel, in captivity, and to literal Israel. It's in captivity. And I hope that the feast this year makes a lot more meaning out of that, what it means to be in captivity, because people can't understand. They don't grasp that what they're in. They don't see what they're in. The only thing they know is that they don't want what you have. Verse 18. When I say unto the wicked, you shall surely die, and you give him not warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from the wicked way, his wicked way, to save his life. That's what we live through. That's what we represent. A way of life that shows how people can come through these things. That's what, frankly, the second book is all about. It's about the ability, if people will listen to God, of being able to escape if they so choose to obey God. And that's the job that God gives to everyone to do. If we don't do that job, then it's upon our head. And that's what God is saying. And it's not a popular message. Never has been. And it certainly isn't going to be the rest of the way through all this. So again here, when I say unto the wicked, you shall surely die. That's not a popular thing when you tell the world what's coming to pass. When people know that there's another war coming, or they're told another war is coming, you're nuts. And yet people are starting to talk about another war, about Europe and the things that are changing over there and what they see coming to pass, things that are happening in the Middle East, things that are so stirred up in those various areas of whether it be Libya, whether it be Egypt, things that are stirred up in those areas of the world, Syria, Lebanon, it doesn't matter where it is, Yemen, Turkey, powerful things going on in that region of the world. You shall surely die, and you give him not warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life. The same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at your hand. God puts a lot of seriousness into it. When we're a part of the church, when we're a part of this way of life, we're to do our part as well. That's why we support and do what we do, because we want that message to go out to the degree that God desires that it go out. Going on finally in verse 19. Yet if you warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, in his sin. But you have delivered your soul. So it's not about selfishness, but it's a matter of obedience still. Whether it be the Sabbath, the holy days, everything else that we live and obey, this is very much a part of what God has given to us as well, to his people, to his church. Always has, when he's given people the responsibility of being, if you will, a watchman. And what does that mean? You know, it's not just, I think in times past, how sometimes a watchman was looked upon as just seeing the physical things going on in the world and what was leading up to the final revival of the Holy Roman Empire, or if even at different time periods, but of the final revival of the Holy Roman Empire, but it's what you have to do in your life. And we've had sermons about that not too long ago, about what it means to be watchful, to be alert, to be on guard. We candidly started that on the last great day of the feast and on past that into sermons that we had about the importance of us being watchful, because the reality is we can't do our job, we can't be right with God, and we can't think right and be able to pray properly and have a right relationship with God unless we are being watchful ourselves, to be alert, to be on guard in our own lives. And then that gives us the ability to do our job better of what God has given charge to us to do in the first place. And so we continue to do it. That's why I look forward to this ministerial meeting, because we're preparing for a final time, leading up to the time that we have all looked forward to for so long. Anyway, going back here, it's not an easy job, and that's the point of what it says here, because people don't want it. People, your family doesn't want to hear what you have to say. Relatives, friends, it doesn't matter who it is, people you work with, they don't want to hear too much from you. But we're going to get to a point in time, candidly, where you are going to be told or asked to begin telling everyone that you come in contact with as a whole, to share what you have with, to talk to them about these things. But that'll be at a time when things are going to be more obvious to them and the world around them as well. Not yet. You know. But when things begin to happen in a very powerful way and people begin to suffer, even you have to step out and tell them why it's happening when the questions come out or when things are asked, or just for the sake of wanting to tell them, for the hope and desire that they're able to hear now what God has given to them to hear. Because if we don't, then that's upon our head, truly. So we'll hear more about that as time goes on. But anyway, going on here in this posting, God's final witness. In 2 short months, the world will be thrust into the 7th and final phase of this end time. This period will be marked by well over 50% of all Bible prophecy being fulfilled. That's an awesome thing to understand that in a short period of time, God is going to accomplish so much. And candidly, most of it's going to happen in the last period of time of that final half a time. This posting cannot cover all the news that's flooding upon the world scene that screams out to a world that is largely asleep. Catastrophic events are about to be unleashed, and very, very few hear the warning cries. God first revealed to his 2 end-time witnesses, his final 2 prophets, that his son would return to this earth in a second coming as King of Kings on May the 27th, 2012. That revelation gave way to numerous other revelations concerning end-time prophetic events. But anyone who hears of this in the world or in the church that was scattered considers them to be absurd, just like we read last Sabbath in Hebrews. That is foolishness to the world. It's foolishness to people. Presumptuous, arrogant, and filled with self-aggrandizement. Such was also true concerning the world's behavior toward Jesus Christ at his first coming. You know, because of what we live through, sometimes when you go back and read some of those stories, they come alive more because we understand them more now. We understand, because of what we go through, we're able to understand more fully things that aren't fully spoken sometimes and why attitudes were there and what they candidly went through. And it gives you greater strength. Going on. It matters little that people will not believe God at this time, as disbelief does not prevent God from doing as he will. All that is stated here is true and will come to pass. There is prophecy in the book of Amos that's directly related to what's been happening in this posting. This is from Amos 3 and verse 7 through 8. The Lord Eternal will do nothing except he first reveal it unto his servants, the prophets. The lion has roared, and who will not fear? The Lord Eternal has spoken, and who can help but prophesy? The point of that is, and sometimes it's easy to miss what is being shown here in Amos, is that there comes a time, because of what has been said, as an example, things written about the end of this age, that in time, headlines that you read in the newspapers, because when they're happening, who can help but prophesy? They don't understand what they're writing, but it's prophecy coming to life. It's like the individual that we had, that I played for you last week, and I'm trying to think of his, Nigel Farage. Anyway, he has another one up that somebody sent me here this past week, and I was told about it as well. But he begins to talk as he's discussing in a panel, as they're talking about Europe and what's happening in Europe and the difference between Britain, why they feel the way they do, and others who have a desire to see Europe come together in a stronger way, because it's dawning upon them finally that the only way that the only way that Europe can survive is if a core group will come together and basically these nations relinquish their power and give it to a federal power over them. Because right now they don't have that kind of power. They haven't given all their power to a single central source. And they realize that's the only way to make this work. And so he was talking about how that he said there are 10 nations ready. Now, I don't know where he got that. He doesn't go on to explain it there. But he says there are 10 nations that are ready to do this. Awesome. Who can help but prophesy? So if he has a feeling about, or because of different ones, of things that different leaders have expressed, and he sees this core group amongst the 17 that use the euro, because, 27 altogether, a part of the system, and they don't all use the euro, but 17 do, that in the midst of all this, somewhere, 10 are going to come together. And that's why I say we live in such awesome times. And you see the headlines that are coming out anymore, and it's like, who can help but prophesy? They're there, like Johnny has mentioned. We have a front row seat. Who can help but prophesy? Yes, God reveals to his prophets in advance what he is bringing to pass. Although many in the world and those in the church that was scattered do not like that a date has been set for the return of Jesus Christ as the Messiah, God has fulfilled his promise to reveal what he does in advance. He has revealed that his Son is to come as the prophesied Messiah on May the 27th, 2012. I have not given this, but God has given this. How many times can I say it? But people don't seem to get it out there. Too bad. Jesus Christ was sentenced to death because he said he was born to be king and that he was the Son of God over and over again. It is the true witness of mankind that that those things spoken of by God's prophets are hated, ridiculed, and slandered. And Jesus Christ was the prophet of all, truly. That's what God calls him, in essence. He was that prophet spoken of by Moses that would come. It was for the reason of this very unjust spirit that God will no longer hold back the tribulation upon the end of this age. So it's still coming. If you were found in the wild where a lion roared, you would fear. But prophecy is roaring and no one seems to fear, no one seems to hear, let alone fear. And the events spoken of in prophecy make a lion at hand seem tame. But headlines and the news contained in it are now roaring so loudly as these contain the exact emergence of what God has long ago given in prophecy. Yes, when it comes to the news, who can but prophesy? And so those were some of the headlines that were mentioned here. Nicolas Sarkozy tells Greece, if you don't stick to the rules, leave the Eurozone. You know, these are awesome things that are being said. And sometimes I hope it hits us in the same way that now we're there. They're being forced into a corner and 10 are going to come together. Another one here, the division of Europe. EU summit paves the way for a split continent. Another one, Whitehall officials urgently review Britain's EU membership. So again, long ago, Mr. Armstrong said Great Britain would not be a part of it. And yet they became a part of it, but he was referring to the final 10 nations, that they would not be together. And so now we see that where they're going to break apart. And that's why we read then, or had written here, Revelation 17, verses 10 through 13. There are seven kings ruling over each kingdom in seven different eras, of which five have fallen and one is. And again, here mentioning that Herbert W. Armstrong was given understanding of this expression. And one is, or of one is, during World War II, when God revealed what was happening then, which was a sixth revival of the Holy Roman Empire. Doesn't mean anything to anybody except to us and to those who were scattered, because they still hold on to this portion. And the other has not yet come. In other words, the time for the seventh and the last revival that would come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. Speaking of the leader of the seventh era, or final revival of the old Rim Empire, that will last but a very short space in time. Briefly existing, in other words. And going on, it says, and the beast, referring to Satan, who was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goes into perdition. You know, to me, a beautiful scripture. He goes into perdition, describing Satan as the one who's actually been over all the kings of the earth, but that he comes to his end eventually, goes to destruction. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. That's an awesome thing to understand. To understand very powerfully so that when they finally do come together, that it's a very short-lived love affair. It's a very short-lived agreement. But once they've entered into it, they can't come back out of it again. So again, referring to those ten nations that make up the final European Union. They have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Then going on, another article or another headline. Merkel says future peace and prosperity at stake in crisis talks. Another one. Merkel wants permanent supervision of Greece. Warns of war. Yeah. Crazy. Well, I'm not going to read all these things. The rest of them, you've read them. But I hope you're keeping up on what's happening in other parts of the world, and I hope you're plugged into those who sometimes send some of those things around so that you're able to keep up on it if you don't know where to look, because it's an awesome thing we're living through. It truly is. Let's turn over to Hebrews 12. Hebrews chapter 12 here today. Because something that we learn through time, which is what you do, and not just two individuals, but what you do as well, and what God has focused upon the church at this end time, because it's about the entirety of the church and what you're living in your life. But he expresses it very powerfully so, in a very succinct way, in two individuals' lives. Being a witness before God is not an easy task for anyone, and that's a part of what it talks about here in Hebrews. Because everyone whom God has called at different times has been a witness, and that's what it talks about here, beginning in verse 1, if I can get there. Hebrews 12 and verse 1. It says, wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Sometimes easier said than done. Can you turn that down just a tad? I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm hot in here. Is anyone warm? Yes, it's hot in here. Definitely. Oh, you want it warmer? Oh. When I get hot, I cannot function very well speaking. Wherefore, seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses. You know what it's talking about? It's talking about, because of chapter 11 and before that, it's talking about all the people who have gone before us. All the people and what they've lived, candidly, over 6,000 years. Those whom God has called, what they've had to live through, because the world hates God. It's not about you. It's not about me. It's about God. We're blessed to be a part of it. We're blessed to live through these things as everyone else in times past who has been a witness. A great cloud of witnesses is talking about here, compassed round about us through time, if we're able to see those things. Let us, as it says here, lay aside every weight, the things that weigh us down. Does anything ever weigh you down? They weigh me down. This world. I am dumbfounded sometimes. The farther we go into this, I think in some ways it can't get any worse. And the world just gets worse and worse and worse. And so much of it today is because of technology and the use of technology and what people are like out here. And the selfishness that's out there is increasing in leaps and bounds. Candidly, it reminds me of a time that God speaks of, has spoken of, before the flood, of how evil man was, but it took him because mankind lived for hundreds of years. Now we have technology to speed up this process, to ruin the mind, to ruin how people live and how they think toward each other. It truly is a sick, sick world. There is nothing here worth saving, save mankind, save the earth, save life. But everything that mankind does and relies upon, none of that's worth saving. There's no system that's worth saving. There's no economic system worth saving. There's no government worth saving. There is none of that. None of it. The religious ideas and teachings, none of it. There's no good in any of it. And so we live through that and we learn that. We come to see how much it resists what would otherwise really be a blessing to mankind. And it helps us to yearn for God that much more. And so it says, lay aside, let us lay aside every weight. In other words, God said, don't let the weight get you down. Don't let that be your focus. Don't let what is happening around you distract you, because it can. The world, on your job, when you go in and you have to do the things you do and living in the society and the world you do day in and day out, it can weigh you down. And it can cause you to become distracted from what God has called you to. And we're entering into a time of all times, you don't want that to happen. And yet it happens. And the sin which does so easily beset us, oh, it's easy to sin. And the world today just draws at you, gnaws at you. You can't watch TV without having to fight attitude and feelings and thoughts and the junk that's out there. Music, it's out there, and you have to be careful. Things that come into your mind, you have to be careful and fight against that which is wrong, that which teaches wrong principles and wrong things. You have to be careful. You have to guard your mind, because, see, that's what's wrong with the world. People aren't guarding their mind and all the stuff. They just receive it and don't think anything of it. And young people grow up thinking that's the way life is, in music, on TV, and life isn't like that. It's a powerful, powerful thing that's happening. And some of the garbage and junk that's out there today, I think of some of this, what's this new series thing that's out there in the movies now? You know, vampires, you know. My wife has always hated those things with a great passion because of the ugliness, the false things that the evil that's in there, that if you drink the blood of someone, you can have life. Where does that come from? We have blood that we can drink once a year in the form of wine to remind us of something about Jesus Christ, that we might have eternal life, that we might be able to come out of sin. And who wants to smear that and ruin that and make it ugly in that respect about? And you think, well, there's no connection. That's different. We're just talking about somebody with long teeth and they like to go around. They get bitten. Once bitten, they're there for eternal life. You know, go around killing people. And yet there are people in God's church who enjoy the books, who enjoy the movies. And I think, what on earth are you guarding against? What on earth are you watching? And why aren't you shaken to the core of your being to hate that kind of garbage? But see, this world can get a hold of you and you don't even know it. This world can get a hold of you, and all of a sudden you're sucked in, and you think, oh, but it's just a romantic story, a nice Romeo and Juliet. Well, what was so great about Romeo and Juliet? I mean, really? Oh, it's a beautiful love story. Yeah, people killing themselves and killing others and poisons and knives and That's a real love story. I'm glad I didn't have it in my life, though. I can do without any of that. See, a right marriage, then now you're talking about a love story and God's church and God's way of life and people striving to live God's way. Yeah, then we can maybe talk about a true love story. Okay? In the book of Solomon, God not afraid to tell us about a true love story and what life is supposed to be like, but not in this cesspool we live in. And if you let this garbage and filth into your mind and you begin to go that far out into demonic things, that's where it comes from. Satan and demons. Why on earth do you want that in your mind? And then someone in God's church even, people will tell you, that's not good, that's not healthy. And you won't listen to them? You won't be warned, even by the ministry? What's wrong? You think, oh, it's okay, it's not going to hurt me. It already has. It already has. If you like it, if you want to be there chewing on your popcorn and drinking your Coke, it's already hurt your mind. We want to entertain ourselves with that kind of stuff. It's not healthy. It's not good. It's exactly what we're talking about. The potential of being pulled away from the truth. The potential of having your mind so messed up. You don't understand what you do to your mind when you give your mind, when you give a part of your mind away to various things that are out there. And then you've got a battle on your hand that it's horrible. It truly is. You've got to fight these things. You've got to fight against these things. These things are not good. These things will not be in God's world. Those books will not be in God's world in the millennium. And you want to talk about some book burning, rather than mystery of the ages, it will be those books. We're going to get things turned around right, where the right things can be printed and the garbage can be burnt, gotten rid of, erased from having influence upon mankind. There's so much damage is done. Today, there's sometimes things come on that just blow my mind. And some of these detective shows, they've gotten worse. You know, sometimes you try to give your mind a little break from the world around you, whatever. And you start watching a program and all of a sudden they're showing things that are so gruesome and sick of what mankind does to mankind, the murders, the evil, the filth that's out there, and people are pumping this into their mind. Young people don't understand the power that's there to distort your thinking, to distort your mind. Anyway. And let us lay aside the weight and the sin that does so easily beset us, come upon us, capture us, hurt our mind. The mind is a precious thing. It truly is. That's what God is saving. He's not saving your body. He's saving your mind. It's your mind and what's in it. He can give you a different body, which is His plan. One that will live for eternity in time, whoever you are. Some sooner and some later. But in time, that's God's plan. But it's your mind and how you think and what you yield yourself for God to mold and fashion that's precious. The healing that's taking place there. But if we continue rubbing shoulders with the world, then you fight against what God seeks to do in His molding and fashioning, your mind and your thinking. Anyway, going on. But that's the world we live in. Technology today makes the evil so much easier to consume and digest in a far faster pace than what happened before the flood. We're there again. The earth, so much of the earth is going to be destroyed. And let us run with patience. That's hard to do sometimes, to be patient. But here we are. We can see, like I mentioned, I think the last Sabbath, the tape across the line now. It's in focus now. We're down to the last half of time. We're almost there. Basically, when that happens, you're just to run faster. You know, I can't help when I talk about things like this to think about my days when I could run. I can't do it anymore. My knees, my mind thinks I could, but I can run a short distance and all of a sudden I realize I can't do it anymore. Doesn't take very long. My knees aren't what they used to be, and so I can't do it. But used to run races, 400 meter, others as well. That was one of the main ones. 100 meter, 400 meter was the main one. And some of those kinds of races, and you start around a track, and of course you can't see the finish line, but because you're running away from it, because that's where it's going to be, where you started, because one lap is 400 meters around the race, around these tracks. And so you start running, and you have to pace yourself, keep pacing yourself, and keep pacing yourself. And you know, by the time you're three-fourths of the way through it, your body is wanting to, it's really wanting to shut down. It's telling you to stop. It does. Whenever you're in a race and you're toward the end of it, your body is, most of the times, this has been my experience, my painful experience, is it's telling you, what are you doing? Are you crazy? Anyway. But you know what? That's when the mind, and you have to, because your strength is gone, you don't have the same strength as when you were halfway through the race, when you're at three quarters, depending on the pace, and you have to fight against your thinking to slow down or to let down. On the contrary, that's when you put more of your mind into your race. And that's where we are now, that you've got to put more of your mind into the race that's in front of us. This is not a time to let down, and yet we've had people who've let down since the feast who are no longer with us. So long running a race. And here we are, we see the tape, and we let down? What's wrong? What's wrong? Only you. Only you can decide and discern and know what you're going to put into it at the end here. So, I don't know about you, but I'm worn out. I am worn out just as much as in a race. I can't wait till May the 27th. I'm looking forward to it with all my being. I truly am. To May the 27th. But I know that I'm worn out. But I know there's a lot left. It's up here in the mind and the battle you put into it. So let us run with patience the race that's set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Keep our eyes on what God has given to us, the truth that God has given us through His Son, because that's how God gives us the truth. It's through His Son. Jesus Christ is the head of the church, and He gives us the truth. He gives us help every Sabbath of what we need to be focused upon, and what we need to think about, what we need to be praying about. Who, for the joy that was set before Him, endured, it says cross in my Bible. It's not true. It's not the Greek word. It doesn't mean cross at all. It's not the word for cross. It's talking about a pole, a stake. No. Talking about what Jesus Christ was nailed to. A pole. Straight up and down pole. Amazing how the world lies. Wants to believe something different. Despising the shame, and is set down on the right hand of the throne of God. Let's go back and see the context of why this was being spoken of back here in Hebrews 11. Let's just pick it up in verse 32. As Paul is talking here, and he says, and what more should I say? He's already talked about different ones here, about Abraham, going back, talking about all the way back here. It starts out in the beginning of the chapter here. Talks about Abel, the first one, the first minister of God, if you will. And what happened to him? His own brother killing him. And then it goes on talking about Enoch and different ones of God, Noah, Abraham. And so it mentions all the different ones, Sarah, all the way through here. Goes on down talking about Jacob and Moses, all through time. And then finally it comes down here then to verse 32. And what shall I say more? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David also and Samuel and of the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, things that have happened over and over again through time, those whom God has called and worked miraculous things in their life, and sometimes the suffering that was allowed in people's lives as a testimony, as a witness of what man is like, quenched the violence of fire, the power of fire, if you will, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens, of those who were there to war. Women received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured. Torture. Happening to God's people. When's the last time you were tortured for what you believe? We have it pretty easy. Matter of fact, we have it real easy in this period of time that we live in right now. Tortured? No. Not accepting deliverance that they might obtain a better resurrection. And others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, including our elder brother Jesus Christ. That's what he went through. Slapping him. Prophesy. Who hit you? Tell us. You're a prophet? Who hit you? Who slapped you? Isn't that sick? The cruelty of a mind that someone who hasn't done anything wrong, not resisting, not fighting them in any fashion or form, taking it, and what they do and what they think and what they say, and the evil of human beings to do some of the things and the atrocities of mankind. Incredible. The trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, beatings, and moreover of bonds and imprisonment, not an unusual thing. It's happened over and over again through time. Think of Jeremiah and what he went through. Joseph and what he went through. Anyway, going on. They were stoned. Talking to Wayne last night and talking about, at least having been stoned, how did I say it? It's better than getting stoned. Anyway, he started laughing because when you talk about getting stoned, anyway. Referring, he knew what I was talking about. Rather than being stoned with stones, the terms we have today, the English language is quite messed up. Talks about they were stoned. A lot of people have been stoned. You know, Paul, drug out like he's dead. You know, I truly do. I think about him oftentimes when we travel. I think about how good we have it. You know, when they see it someday, and you tell them, yeah, had to sit here for 14 hours to get down to Australia. Where'd you sit? What kind of chairs? At an airport where you could go get food any time you wanted to. Bathrooms easily accessible. On the plane, get anything you want to eat any time as a whole. You know, maybe not exactly what you want all the time. That's pretty rough. You know, and here, you look at what he went through, different ones and what they went through. I think about him often when his travels and so forth and what he did, because he traveled a lot as an apostle of God. And he went through a lot, beaten, shipwrecked. His travel wasn't nearly as easy as ours was. You know, and we should think about those things. We have it easy in comparison. Whenever you think your load is heavy, when you feel like you're weighted down, please think again. Remember this company of witnesses that surround us, as we talked about there in chapter 12, because that's what God says to do. Remember them, what they went through. Then look upon what you're going through and be thankful. Be thankful. They were stoned. They were sawn asunder. You know, the cute little magic trick of having a box and someone inside of it and sawing through it. Not a pretty thing when you know where it came from and what it was about. You know. Incredible. Things used in the world. They were tempted. They were slain with a sword. They wandered about in sheepskin and goatskin. Haven't had to do that. Have to wear a tie, which I don't like. That's pretty tough, isn't it? Well, a lot of people gone before us had it pretty hard different times in their life to be a witness of God's way of life. So whenever you think you have it tough or life is hard around you, please stop and think about some of them, because that's what God's telling us to do. And understand to always be thankful for the load you're carrying, because it isn't much of a load. We still feel it. It isn't easy. It isn't easy in the mind when you deal with family who is against you. It isn't easy dealing with society who is against you, but God will give you the help. As I talked about in Ezekiel. And you have to be careful sometimes of some of that as well, because it can be misused, of the hardness of your head. Yeah. God says Israel has a hard head anyway. All people have hard heads when it comes to God's way of life. All people. And it's one thing to be able to have that right mind and right thinking towards others around you when it comes your way, that you don't take it personally. You know, I remember back in, I'm trying to think of the year, it was after we left Cincinnati here. It must have been about 87, 88. And went through a period of time in an area where things were so bad in that area, it was kind of a training ground for apostasy that was going to come later on. And things got to be so bad in that area there that when you have people you feel very close to in congregations, and back then congregations were much larger, several hundred in most places, and we had a couple of areas we served. And I went through a period of time where it was hard. And I was taking it personally because they were friends. And friends that turn against you and friends that begin to, within a body, within a church, that begin to say things that are untrue and so forth, and begin to hate what they're being taught and so forth, which you can take personally, until God reminded me, which sometimes we need to be reminded of. It's not us. Why do we take things personal? It's God. It's the truth that people don't like. It's God's way of life that people don't like. You may receive the brunt end of it, but you can't take it personal. So, Samuel, that's what God basically had to tell him. It's not you. It's me they hate. So Samuel had to learn through that. It's not about him. It's just that he received the brunt end of it as far as a human being is concerned. But it's about attitude toward God. And when you understand those things, then you can have greater compassion upon others, like we read last Sabbath about Stephen. Father, forgive them. Can you always have that attitude about people you go to work with, your coworkers, different ones who make fun of your Sabbath keeping, of your holy days, of whatever it is else you have in your life, and they make fun of those things about you, what you believe? Oh, May the 27th, huh? Can't wait till that day comes, you know. And they give you a hard time about it. Well, you can't take it personal, but sometimes we do. Sometimes we even try to defend that we're right. We went through a period of time like that with the 50th truth. That's not what it's all about, is it? Amazing. Anyway, going on. They wandered about in sheepskin and goatskin, being destitute. God's blessed us as a church, mightily so. From Philadelphia on, the church has been awesomely blessed. People who have come into God's church as a whole, being obedient to God, people are mightily blessed, truly. Afflicted, troubled, it's a word for that, tribulation, tormented. So it's not meant to be easy all the time. We go through things, indeed. Of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and in caves of the earth. So again, that's why this is written. So that there comes a time when people are able to look at something like this and say, you know, I have it pretty easy. You can go out and jump in your car. You can put gasoline in it. You don't have to follow behind anyway. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promises. All through time, in that amazing 6,000 years, people live this way of life, the ones whom God has called, and we're the ones who are blessed to live at the time they all wanted to see. That's awesome. It really is. To live in this time, to have a few months ahead of us, just a tad, 6 months, 6 months away. It's almost unbelievable. I can understand the world. I can understand others. Because even for us, it's something we don't grasp because we haven't lived it yet. Faith, but we believe it. For all the truth that God has given to us, we live our lives. That's why we live our lives this way, because we believe it. It's a beautiful thing, living by faith and what God gives to us. All these, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. We do. Some into a world that people have looked forward to for a long, long time, a millennial period. God's world. No longer Satan and demons around. No longer any unjust governments on the earth. They'll learn. They'll be taught. Everything coming into unity, justice with God through time. One church. One church. The truth only being spoken and taught. No heresies allowed into God's church. Nothing like what happened during the apostasy or at any time when different ones went astray from the truth. None of that to be allowed in God's church, so that no one is ever hurt ever again who has God's Spirit living and dwelling within them. They can't be hurt by a minister who begins to go astray and begins to teach some of his own ideas. It won't be allowed in God's church in the future. No confusion of religion like there is today with all the ideas and religions that are out there, let alone within traditional Christianity. There's such massive confusion there alone, let alone with all the other religious beliefs that are out there. None of that. And so you get to live into that age, whether continuing on as a physical human being, and for some, to actually be a part of the God family. We live in an awesome time. Awesome. And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better thing for us, that they without us should not be made perfect or become complete. In other words, they have to wait until the rest of the plan is there in place, and now we're there. The rest of the plan is now being put in place. The final touches, the final ending of it all, the final end of the end, if you will, when you talk about that seventh period of a half a time. And then it goes into chapter 12 and talking about, wherefore, seeing we're also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight. Remember what you have. Think about what you have. Be thankful to God for what you have. And especially that you haven't had to go through, truly, what some of the others have had to go through. That doesn't mean times are not going to get harder here as we go toward the end, as we're in the end. But even there, God gives deliverance because that's what He's called you for. All those are going to be a part of 144,000, not a big thing if they don't make it all the way. The others, all the rest, God has called you to be in a new age. That's your purpose. If you'll just yield yourself to it, you will be there. It's God's promise. It's what He's called you to. What an awesome thing. He will deliver. He'll give it to you. And so we read about being a witness, and this talks about a cloud of witnesses because they're all of them, all of their lives, it's a witness of what it was like to live in this earth at different times, under different whatever it was, at different ages that they came upon. God having a witness out of every age of people that He's called who have lived for 6,000 years. And now, in a period of 3.5, God says this is a time in a powerfully righteous, just way on the earth to have a reflection in just a short period of time, 3.5 years, that mankind is still the same. It's an awesome thing, especially when you understand God's judgment and what He's doing. And so we have scriptures like Revelation 11:3, because it's about witness, it's about a testimony. It says, I will give, and the word power isn't there, but it has to do with power. Revelation 11:3, I'll just read it to you. Unto my two witnesses. It's not just, again, that's why God is letting us know it's not just about two witnesses, but that's the focus of that special period of time because of what God is doing. It's about everyone in God's church in that respect of what we're witnessing at the end of a period of time and truly other things that will happen in two specifically. And they shall prophesy 1,260 days, yes, 1,260 days, in other words, clothed in sackcloth. It's about humility. It's about how we're all supposed to live during this period of time. It's not a matter of trying to prove to others or losing face or being ashamed or whatever it might be. We yield ourselves to God and what God is doing, and that's what it's about. It's about our attitude toward God. It's about the attitude of how we live toward others. And truly, that's why in the period of time coming here, it's good to think about some of this, of how you treat others around you. To have the attitude that Jesus Christ had, to have the attitude that Stephen had, no matter how bad it gets, no matter what happens, no matter how people treat you, you better be forgiving toward them. You better not let things in your spirit and your heart well up in you to where you have bitterness or anger or resentment or hatred. Those things are not of God. So think about those things as you continue to go forward, of how you feel about others who sometimes come down upon you. Because we're to be a right kind of witness that God has given us of His way of life, of Him living inside of us. And we're not to respond and react like the world does. Okay? We're not to respond in kind. That's why it's so important in life and in family that if someone becomes upset, that you don't respond in like manner, that you don't become upset and let your voice rise and become angry, because when you do that, you sin, and it's not God living in you then. And so God is very concerned about, indeed, how we live our life all the time, in family, in the environment of the church, in the world around us, because they all have to be judged differently, but always with the spirit of love. That's a unique thing, isn't it? God so loved the world. Do you see the end result of why we're on this earth? And do you look forward to, as we talked about the Feast of Tabernacles, do you look forward to the time, do you truly look forward to the time that people are freed from the bondage, the captivity they're in? Thought about that driving here today, all the way here. This world that's so deep in captivity. Do we have that yearning desire like God has for mankind to see us get past this final stage in order for people to finally be made free so they can begin to see what you see, to embrace what you embrace? And so when people do things toward you or say things about you or be at work or whatever it might be, or family members, and today things are stirred up like a giant stick out there, things are so stirred up. Do you understand why? Do you really understand why? And because of that understanding, then able to deal with it the way God wants you to deal with it? Do we believe and understand with every fiber of our being, we know where it's coming from? That there are beings out there throwing a temper tantrum in spirit because they hate you and this is their last hurrah and they want to stir up the world around you? Truly, that's what's going on out there. Since the feast, it has gotten much worse out there in people's lives and what people are having to deal with. People being bombarded. And it's thick. How can you describe it? It's like you can feel it. A pressure. A stress that's in the world. That the world has. And you've got to be careful you don't get caught up in it. That you understand where it's coming from. Otherwise, those same beings, you know, Don't let them have any joy for being able to cause you any harm. They hate it when you live by faith. They hate it when you love God. They hate it when you love God's people. They hate it when you love people. And you are forgiving towards everyone. They hate that. They want you to get upset. They want you to get upset within your own family. That's what they want. They want to stir things up and make things ugly, where people say bad things and do bad things and have bad feelings. Don't let them have any satisfaction in any of that. Truly. Understand there's a spiritual war going on in a very powerful way right now. It's about to erupt in a physical one on the earth. So again, the witness is a reflection of the last 6,000 years, both of God's true witness, testimony to mankind about what mankind is like. You know, I think of people who've gone by the wayside over the years since I've been in God's church because they got tired of hearing about human nature, their human nature. But that's a blessing. When God shows us what we're like and we're able to see it and we understand it, then we know what to battle. We know what to fight against. What's bad about that? All you do is accept it and repent. And that's the toughie sometimes for some people. That's why some people have gone by the wayside, because they really don't want to repent. They don't want to change what they're doing. Well, I thought I'd read here at this point here the new post that I just sent out, because there are people out there who don't have internet and they can only hear it through the telephone hookup like today. Since I did tell people out there that they're going to hear a post. And there are going to be different reactions. In the church, it helps to be unified. In the world, it's not good. because of the way of the world. Anyway, this would be my response to the indictment concerning the accusation of using church funds for personal use beyond normal income, which in turn is being used to say I did not pay taxes upon those funds. I've rewritten this posting several times, as this entire matter has been rather difficult for me to digest. I have been waiting to find out the full details of the indictment, and it has been somewhat unsettling, as it simply takes time to receive all the information that is based upon. Although we have known that an investigation has been underway since mid-2008, it is all rather difficult to understand why. There really is no basis for this. The investigation that covers several years has been difficult to understand, especially in light of the fact that we have never at any time received any civil notice from the IRS. There has never been a request for an audit, of which we would have fully cooperated, as our desire has always been to do things correctly in filing our taxes. The church has a great team of lawyers and an investigator who are vigorously working to defend me and the church. As people tend to believe what they will, I've decided that a posting is not the forum to address the issues at hand, but to fully use our legal system and the courts to do so. Laura and I understand that this is part of what we must face as part of the work we believe God has given us to do at this end time. We will continue to do as we have ever since we became part of the ministry of God's church back in 1981. That makes over 30 years of serving in the ministry. Indeed, we have always sought to faithfully and zealously serve God and His church, although we went through a period of sluggishness and sleep, you know, which the entire church did. We understand that. But still in heart, that has always been the desire. Our plans have not changed, and we will continue as we do now by visiting the many congregations of the church which are scattered throughout the United States and other countries. It is true that the church maintained funds in Switzerland for several years, yet it's also true that this was fully disclosed to the church before that account was ever opened. And then I've given the place where that can be found on the church website, the audio section, December the 28th, 2002, in a sermon entitled Planning Ahead. As it was stated in that sermon, those funds were placed in my name, yet there was also another name on that account as an additional representative, in parenthesis here, an evangelist, speaking of now, of the church who had full access and legal right to those church funds at any time. They weren't my funds. They've always been the church's. Consequently, because of our beliefs that 2008 was the beginning of trouble for the world and what would eventually lead to a complete global economic collapse, we began investing several hundred thousands of dollars in advertising in order to warn people of what was coming and what was happening even then. Those church funds were all brought back to the United States and all used in that advertising. It's like right now, we're holding in reserve a good portion in order to use for one last phase of advertising. But as things begin, when trumpets become clear of what's taking place out here, and then we're going to hit the same kind of advertising again. Anyway, going on. This posting also provides me with the opportunity to remind our readers of two important doctrines of the church. One concerns tithing and government taxation, and the second concerns our teaching of what it means to be a good citizen in a country where one lives. Concerning the first of those two doctrines I have referred, we adhere to a strong belief in tithing and giving of offerings, as many other Christian churches and those in Judaism also believe. We deeply believe the instruction of Jesus Christ, who said that we should pay to Caesar what is Caesar's, and then in quotations here, parenthesis, I should say, taxation to be paid to government agencies, that's what Christ was talking about, and to God what is God's, referring to tithes and offerings. Members are to be as zealous in being faithful to God in tithing as they are faithful to God in paying their taxes and whatever government is over them. Going on, concerning the second doctrine in which I've referred, you can read on the church website what the church teaches about being a good citizen in a country, especially as we draw nearer to the end of the final 3.5 years of this end time. This is stated in the FAQ section under the topics and is entitled Citizenship in a Nation. As the church continues to remain faithful to God, God is faithful to lead us and to fight our battles for us. Indeed, we look to God and His Son, Jesus Christ, to guide our way and always deliver us. So that's how we live our life. It isn't what some out there would like to hear, but it's the truth. Anyway, going on, let's notice John chapter 7 here as we go on in this series here, because it's an awesome thing here, what God has said through time about what it means to be a witness. And to me, what an incredible thing here, title of a book, 2008, God's Final Witness, and to understand what that's meant for all time and to understand what that's meant since December of 2008, going forward, I think, what an awesome thing that God is focusing upon that as a powerful witness for the end of the age, summing it up in 1260 days, if you will, basically. So John chapter 4, again here, it's quite incredible what happened when God's own Son, Jesus Christ, was a witness and gave witness to this world. And if the world, again, as I said earlier in the sermon, wouldn't accept God's own Son, they certainly have not accepted others. And that's our life. It's always been the life of those in the church or those whom God has worked with, if you want to talk about the first 4,000 years. John 7 and verse 1, it says, "After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him." It's amazing. It still wasn't time, but this was around the Feast of Tabernacles, and Passover is the time he was to die. And so here is this last period of time here as he's entering into it, and he's at the Feast of Tabernacles period is what we're talking about here. And it says he purposely was in a different region in that respect, God leading him there, being with him, and knowing full well that those around Jerusalem, the Jewish leaders there and so forth, were out to kill him, but his time wasn't there. Now, the Jews' Feast of Tabernacle was at hand. It was the Feast of Tabernacles, but certainly referring to something of the Jews here, because even then they didn't observe it in the way God told them to. You know, there are things that they began to do long before, and Jesus Christ told them all the things they were doing were filled with hypocrisy and lying, even in their time. And you think, well, anyway, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Zealots, all the different groups that were there, they were all wrong when it came to obeying God. They knew the right time, but they did not obey God in the way things were to be observed. And so that's why it's referred to this way, because it was theirs of what they were doing in Jerusalem, basically making a distinction here. It wasn't the way God gave to it. Sometimes people read the wrong things into this. Now, the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. His brothers, therefore, said to him, see, traditional Christianity would say, see, it's the Jews. It's the Jews' feast. Nothing about being God's. Anyway, notice it says the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. His brothers. Now, this is hard for the Catholic Church because they don't believe he had brothers. This is not talking about brethren. It's talking about brothers, literally. And there was an exception here, too, with a couple. But as a whole, his brothers here being referred to, they didn't believe him. They didn't believe who he was. And this is what it's talking about here. His brothers, therefore, said to him, "Depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples also may see the works that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly." If you want to be known openly, you can't be up here in Galilee doing this in secret. They were mocking him somewhat, making fun of him, in essence. If you do these things, if you do these things, show yourself to the world. In other words, if you are who you say you are. So, in essence, they had what spirit? The same spirit of anyone who is not being drawn to God, the same spirit of anyone in the world that can't see. And if they can't see, what are they going to say? They're not going to say good things. They just didn't know. God hadn't given them the ability to see. And so their natural carnal human reaction was to do what normal carnal human reaction is, to dislike the truth. For even his brothers did not believe in him. They did not believe him. Then Jesus said unto them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always ready." You know, you're of the world. Your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify, witness, that's what the word is, of it, that its works are evil. Not a popular message that goes out. You go back and you read the Old Testament, there are different prophets that went to the kings, and sometimes they'd be so upset, and they'd be like, "What have you brought to us? You never bring us good news. You know, what is it you've got to tell us this time? Why are you here?" In other words, whenever a prophet came around, a lot of times that was a response of those who weren't following God. Now, for those who were, they received them. Some in Judea, some of the Jewish kings, they did receive some of the prophets through time. But most of the times, even those of Judaism, and especially those of Israel, they never liked a prophet coming around. Because to them, it was always like, what bad thing are you going to tell us now? You know, you always bring us bad news. And that's, well, why? Because they're disobeying God. It's not good news. It's not going to be good news if you're disobeying God. It's going to be bad news because bad things are going to come upon you. And so God's telling you and warning you, if you don't quit what you're doing and if you don't repent, this is what's going to happen to you. Now, amazing. The human mind. Incredible. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify, I witness of it, that its works are evil. Not a well-received message. And it wasn't well-received by his brothers who didn't believe who he was. You, going on here, says, you go up to this feast, telling his brothers, you go on up the feast, the rest of the family there. I'm not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come. In other words, in its complete story here, what Christ was saying, I'm not going up with you. They were led to believe whatever they wanted to believe, and they believed that he was going to stay behind, and so they went on up the feast. That's what they did. And when he had said these things to them, he remained in Galilee. In other words, the rest left. They went on up, just as Christ had said. But when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast. So after they had already arrived there, he knowing the time, then he also went up to the feast. Why? To obey God. He wasn't not going to go. He was going to obey his father, but not the way his brothers wanted him to, the ones who didn't believe. So when he said these things to them, he said he remained in Galilee. But when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. Not the way they wanted him to, but the way that God had given him to. Then the Jews sought him out at the feast and said, where is he? So they were looking for him anyway, because why? Because his tradition was always to be obedient to God, so you would expect him to be there. And so they were out looking for him. Why? They wanted to kill him. They wanted to put him to death. They wanted to get rid of him. They hated him so much and what he had to say. Going on. And there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said, he is good. Others said, no, on the contrary, he deceives the people. So there's this controversy going on because people were talking about things that had happened and things were going on. And, you know, the thing with John the Baptist was not a small thing. And now the thing with Christ and his disciples was not a small thing. And all the stories that were going around, especially at a gathering like this, when people came in from so many areas who had seen things and testified to things they had seen. But as a whole, others didn't like those things that they heard, especially religious leaders. And so there was this battle going back and forth. Some saying, no, he's on the contrary, he deceives the people. However, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. So they were even afraid amongst themselves to talk too much openly, because especially if it was anything of a good report, because of fear of those Jewish leaders, that somehow this could come back on them. And so people were really afraid to open up. You know, it's like that in the world. I know there are people out there who listen right now who aren't ready to make a commitment fully, curious, see things in the world, there are things that make sense, but can't make that extra step. I understand that. Yeah. Because oftentimes there's a greater fear of what others are going to say, family, people on the job, and I'm really not ready for that yet. Just wait a little longer. Okay. I understand. When you see things happening, please, please, as I've said in the past, get off the pot and repent. Truly. Because when things begin to fly around you, you're going to want God's protection, and you're going to want it for your family. You're going to want it for others around you whom you love. Moreover, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Now about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up to the temple and taught. Whew. Here we are, halfway into the feast, and now he's actually going up the temple to speak, to teach. And the Jews marveled, saying, how does this man know letters, having never studied? In other words, it wasn't taught by the normal process there, like Saul was, different ones were that had various training there in Jerusalem amongst the religious leaders and institutions they had there, and the various teachers they had there at that time. And goes on to say here, Jesus answered and said to them, "My doctrine is not mine, but he who sent me." Beautiful. It's the way it's always been. It comes from God. What is true comes from God. No one's the source of that. No human being is the source of that. If anyone has the truth, it's because God has given it to them. It's about God. Even Jesus Christ, his own son, said, "The words that I speak to you, they're not mine. They didn't come out of my thinking. They came from God. My doctrine is not mine, but he who sent me. If anyone wills to do his will, he shall know concerning the doctrine whether it's from God or whether I speak of mine own authority. He who speaks from himself seeks his own glory, but he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is true, and no unrighteousness is in him." Well, they didn't understand any of that. And candidly, until you're a part of God's church, do you have access to God's Spirit, and God's Spirit helps you to begin to understand what these things are about? People in the world read them, and they don't comprehend what's being said. He said, "Did not Moses give you the law, yet none of you keeps the law?" That goes over well, doesn't it? Yeah. That's going to be a real winner when you tell people what you believe is not true. What you're living is not true. You claim to be of God? Tell that to traditional Christianity. Got tongue tied on the T's there. Tell that to traditional Christianity. Don't say that real fast. And what happens? Tell them about, like I mentioned last Sabbath, things about the cross. That it's an absolute bald-faced lie. And they don't like that. Tell them that it's a pole, a stake, if you will, a pole in the ground, and that's how he was hung up there and why. And it's not that hard to prove these things. Truly, if somebody really wanted to, the seventh-day Sabbath, from Friday sunset to Saturday sunset, it isn't really that difficult to prove in Scripture if somebody's willing to go through that process and really see what's there. Mr. Armstrong was challenged to do that. Of course, God was drawing him and leading him to the truth, but nevertheless, his beginning of that was to disprove his wife. And there are people out here, Seventh-day Adventists, who are not a part of God's church, who have proven to themselves the seventh day is true and correct. They're by the millions. There are people out here who can prove it if they so choose to do it, but people don't choose to do that because they've been taught something else and they want to hold on to it and to those beliefs connected with it, not to somebody else's beliefs. Anyway. He said, "Didn't Moses give you the law, yet none of you keeps the law? Why do you seek to kill me?" And the people answered and said, "You have a demon. Who's seeking to kill you?" He knew what was in their heart, was in their mind. He knew what was there. God gave it to him to know it. And they were just lying. Their desire was to destroy him, to get rid of him. That was their true motivation. But they had a difficult time accepting their true motivation, especially when it came out in the open there. And Jesus answered and said to them, "I do one work, and you all marvel. Moses therefore gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers." In other words, Moses didn't come up with the idea of circumcision. It was being practiced before that by our forefathers. And he says, "And you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses should not be broken because of what they were teaching, what they believed, are you angry with me because I have made a man completely well, healed on the Sabbath?" It's like, you're working on the Sabbath. How can you... to live back in that time, is to me, is a little dumbfounding to think that they could think that way. Here's someone, and he tells someone who can't walk to walk different things of miracles that were done. People who are blind, they can see their whole life, and people able to give testimony of that. And so he heals someone on the Sabbath day, and they find fault with that. You know, you broke the law of Moses. You think, what man has the power to heal? If you can't acknowledge this comes from God, it's like the apostasy in the church. How could anyone deny the church was scattered? How can anyone deny that we fulfill what is spoken of in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2? But they do. But the truth is, how can anyone deny that a great falling away took place and that they're the product of it? They don't have what they used to. Their very lives are a testimony that they don't have what was there before. Mind-boggling. Shows the hardness of heart of the human spirit when you're asleep spiritually, or when you come, or when you're at a point where you're just going to fight against God no matter what, no matter what truth is staring you in the face. Anyway, and so he's trying to reason with them on those planes. He knows they're not going to hear, but still he throws this out there at them. And so he tells them, do not judge according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment. That's a toughie for human beings. Don't judge from the way you see things by your own thinking. Try to go a little beyond that and judge righteously because it's true. Look at this a little closer. He didn't explain that, but how can a man heal anyone? A man can't. God can. And if someone speaks and says those things and it happens, this is of God. What I say is from God. What I say is true. They wouldn't accept it. They weren't judging righteous judgment. Going on, verse 25. Now some of them from Jerusalem said, is this not he whom they seek to kill? Even the other people knew. Isn't this the one they're trying to kill? That's why they were afraid to speak, because they were afraid of repercussions coming upon them if anyone saw a good testimony and spoke of it. They didn't want to speak in public. That's exactly what they're discussing here. And so they were very careful of where they spoke and when they opened their mouths. And so some that heard some of these things, then they ask, isn't this the one that they're trying to find? Here he's in the middle of feast. As it said here, it was the middle of feast, and he's speaking these words. And isn't he the one that they're after to kill? And that's what he just told them. You're trying to kill me. Oh, you have a demon. Anyway, you read stories like this, and they're just hard to grasp, only because we know what we know. But it shows the hardness of the human spirit, the resistance against God. It says, but look, he speaks boldly, and they say nothing to him. Do the rulers know indeed that this is truly the Christ? Do they really know then that he is the Messiah? That's what they're saying. Is this why they're not saying anything right now while he's up there? However, we know where this man is from. But when the Christ comes, no one knows where he's from. Then Jesus cried out, as he taught in the temple, saying, you both know me, and you know where I am from, and I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. But I know him, for I am from him, and he sent me. Therefore you sought to take him. Therefore, it says, they sought to take him, but no one laid a hand on him. It says, because his hour had not yet come. So it wasn't being allowed by God. God's in charge. And nothing's going to happen before it's time, until it's God's time. That's why Christ told them, you said, you can't do anything to me unless God gives it to you. And that's the truth. That's the way it is in our lives as well. That's the way it is in your life. That's the way it is in my life. It says, but no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. And for whatever reasons, motivations, and other things that were there. And many of the people believed in him and said, when the Christ comes, will he do signs, more signs than what this man does? Because the attitude of mine at any time they went through troubled times was, is this the time for the Messiah? Is this the time that God's going to send the Messiah to deliver us? Because that's been the whole thing through time. And the desire to look for, even though the understanding was shallow throughout the Old Testament of what it was all about, a desire to see one come who would be king, who would take them away from whatever rule was over them. And so when they have been in captivity, when various things have happened to them, and now because of the Romans that were there, they had a great desire that the Messiah would come. And so when the Messiah comes, is he going to do greater things than what this man is doing? And that was the question. And the reality was, he's the Messiah, and no, they're not going to do greater things, or no one's going to do greater. He is the Messiah. The Pharisees heard the crowd murmuring these things concerning him, And the Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers to take him. They didn't like what was going on. They didn't want the people talking about this or discussing the possibility that this is the Messiah and to be in awe of him and what he is saying and doing. Then Jesus said to them, I shall be with you a little while longer, and then I go to him who sent me. You will seek me and will not find me, and where I am, you cannot come. So often talking in parables and saying things that no one could understand, even his own disciples didn't understand until they became a part of the church, until Pentecost, and then they could understand. Then the Jews said among themselves, where does he intend to go that we shall not be able to find him? Where can he go? You know, we can't find him. And does he intend to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks, to those who are scattered amongst the Greeks, and teach in those regions, like what Paul was given to do? And the word isn't just Greeks here, it's other nations, other places, because anytime the word is used there, it's any place else besides Judea, any other areas, but it's referring primarily to the northern regions, especially where Israel was taken captive farther to the north. What is this thing that he said, you shall seek me and not find me, and where I am you cannot come? I wasn't going to go through that much, but I guess we will here, continue on here. But anyway, let's read the rest here. Verse 37, and on the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood up and cried, saying, if anyone thirst, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture says, out of his heart, out of his inner being, in other words, will flow rivers of living water. I'm reading this in the New King James, and I really don't like it that much because they've inserted words there that aren't true as well, but I hate to use some of the old English as well. I'm constantly having to translate when I do that. But anyway, this he spoke concerning the Spirit, whom those believing in him would receive, for the Holy Spirit was not yet given because Jesus had not yet been glorified. Therefore, many from the crowd, when they heard this saying, said, truly, this is the prophet. Speaking of that prophet spoken of by Moses. Others said, this is the Messiah. So there are some who were moved by those sayings. And then some said, basically, but will Christ come out of Galilee? Can the Messiah come out of Galilee? So there's this, they can't just nail it because of different feelings and beliefs. And even back then, it's much worse today than it was back then, different ideas and beliefs that people had. It goes on to say here then, has not the scripture said that the Christ comes from the seed of David and from the town of Bethlehem where David was? Doesn't he have to come out of Bethlehem? And so people can't understand, they don't grasp things that God has said. And indeed, isn't meant oftentimes that they grasp everything, but going on. So there was a division among the people because of him. It reminds me candidly of what some in the scattered body say today concerning, candidly, two witnesses. They can't come out of a group like that. To believe those things, to believe that Jesus Christ hasn't eternally existed, that's not God's church. It can't be them. It can't be from them, although they all look to that period of time, that they know it's going to come sometime, but it's far, far, far away. And what's happening in Europe is a long way up the road yet. Truly, that's what they believe. Even though it's happening right under their nose very fast right now, to them, it's not conceivable that it can happen in a few months' time. Candidly, the 10 nations could come together in a month. It's inconceivable. It can happen that soon. Might be 2 months, might be 3 months, might be 4 months. We don't know. We'll know when it happens. But the reality is, pushed into a corner, they're going to do what they do quickly. It isn't something that takes a long time to come together. It isn't something that they're going to have the luxury of waiting a long time because of the economy of the world and what's happening. You know, what, Belgium downgraded now? You know, Portugal downgraded, talks about being down, Germany can't sell its bonds. This is unthinkable, things that are happening. You think this isn't moving people over there to come up with a plan and do it quick? They've got to, and they know it. Awesome. Pushed into a corner to survive. Reading something very interesting here, sent from Willem Henderson to me the other day, from over there in the Netherlands, talking about papers that were found after World War II and a meeting of various officials, if you will, of the Nazi Party and the Gestapo and different ones in Strasbourg. At the very end, in latter part, I think it was latter part of 1944, when they knew that they weren't going to come through this, they were already planning on what to do later on, because they knew it was coming to an end. They knew that they couldn't win the war. And so it came to that point in time where they came together in a secret meeting of documents which have been since found and called the Red something or other. I can't think of it, the Red House or Red something or other papers. But anyway, in those papers, they discuss how there are going to be a desire to funnel monies in and through, which they've already been doing, in Switzerland. That's why it's always been a neutral country. They could do that even during the war and have all their wealth there and invest it into foreign corporations later, as soon as it's over. Awesome story that their plan the next time around was to come back big, but to do it in an economic manner and not a military, not one of a military. That was their plan, not to use military next time, but to do it in an economic fashion. And whether people later on understood some of those things that were decided then, but that's exactly what happened. There's actually the documentation of some things that goes on to talk about some of the very companies and banks today that exist today that started back then, right at the end. Certain individuals who were actually placed in charge of some of these things after the end of the war, who had been some of the very ones who committed some of the atrocities, some they killed, some they put to death, others actually became a part of the system again, of building up the that part of the world once again. Incredible what's happened through time. But it's a marvel what's happening now is not a matter of a military, because that's candidly what a lot of the scattered church is looking for. They cannot believe that Europe can come together quickly because they don't see a large military presence. Not knowing the next war is not as much about a military power as the very things the Soviets are doing, not Soviets, I can't call them that now, the Russians are doing right now, and what Medvedev and Putin and this other general have made comment about this past week, that they have a, I believe I have this correctly, if Yuri can correct me here, if not, because he watches this news, but they have a million-man army. I think it's script by script, right? They have to become a part of it. What we call it, the draft here. And so they have this military that they've tried to maintain, and they're not going to do it in the same manner anymore. They're going to begin cutting down on some of that. And their acknowledgement basically is one that they're going to rely more, kind of back to the Cold War thing, to nuclear weapons. That's going to be their strength and their power. Well, that's already the strength and power in Europe. It's already there. NATO. A lot of missiles scattered throughout Europe. Already there. And anyway, you think the church is asleep, the scattered church, I should say. Sad. And to me, that is sad. I wish people could see so they could change, so they could be a part with us. Anyway, going on here. And so they're going on here talking about, basically, it can't be because he's supposed to come out of Bethlehem and where David was, and not knowing he did come out of Bethlehem and went into Egypt for a time and then back up in the area of Galilee and so forth, his family did. Going on, so there was a division among the people because of him. Now, some of them wanted to take him, but no one laid hands on him. Then the officers came to the chief priests and Pharisees, who said to them, "Why have you not brought him?" So they sent them out to get him, and they come back empty-handed. And because of all the things that people were saying and so forth, and so this is their response. The officers answered, "No man has ever spoken like this man. No one's ever said these kinds of things before." Then the Pharisees answered them, "Are you also deceived? Have any of the rulers or the Pharisees believed in him? But this crowd that does not know the law is accursed." And then Nicodemus speaks up. He was the one who went to Jesus by night, being one of them, said to them, "Does our law judge a man before it hears him and knows what he's doing?" Yeah. Nicodemus was of a little bit different cut of a cloth, if you will. He even helped at the very end concerning the death of Christ. And very likely moved by some of the things that were taking place, but a little more in that respect level-headed about some of those things that were taking place. Then they answered and said to him, "Are you also of Galilee?" You know, anyone dare to speak up. Nicodemus spoke up, and that's a put down. See, they knew Christ was from Galilee. "Are you also from Galilee?" No educated person comes out of Galilee. That was their attitude. That's why I think about the disciples at different times and where Christ picked them up and got them from different walks of life and people that oftentimes were looked down upon, just as we are. Different walks of life, different backgrounds, and that's why it dumbfounds the world. That's why God says he calls different ones that aren't the great in the world to confound those who are considered the great and the mighty. And then we change. Indeed, going to dumbfound the world in time. Then they answered and said unto him, are you so also of Galilee? And then it goes on to say, search and look, for no prophet has arisen out of Galilee. So it can't be Jesus. And it says everyone went to his own house. So anyway, what a crazy story. Things that have happened through time. Going on here in the next chapter, and we read a lot of this at the feast, especially that which follows, but I want to read a portion of this. John 8 and verse 12. Then Jesus spoke to them again, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. And the Pharisees therefore said to him, you bear witness of yourself. Your witness is not true. And Jesus answered and said to them, even if I bear witness of myself, my witness is true. For I know where I came from and where I'm going. But you do not know where I come from and where I'm going. You know, an awesome thing, people in the world don't understand those things about what it means to be a witness. And I think about in the very beginning, I've said this before, how hard it was to write in the first book, at the end of the book, about a prophet. I even put a milder, if you will, meaning of what the word was, because there was no way at that time to accept what came later that candidly was fighting against, resisting. And yet those things are true. When something is true, it is what it is. You know, for all of us who are part of the church, for who we are, what we represent, we know who we are. All of God's people have known who they are through time. And that's what Christ is explaining here. He knew where he came from. He knew where he was going. He knew all that was true that God had given to him. And that's why he's speaking these things in this fashion. He says, even if I bear witness of myself, my witness is true. Powerful. Some people don't like people saying those things. I had someone in the church ask the question, why do you have to tell anyone these things? Why do you have to tell anyone you're a prophet? It's my job for this very sort of thing. It goes with the territory. It is what it is. Though people believe, those who are led by God's Spirit, they will come to believe and see those things, whatever God gives. And that's the way it's been through time. And those who aren't, it just gives them more reason to reject it. No. Didn't he grow up in Kansas? Now, I'm going to get it from my family out there. I can tell you that right now. I had some great teachers, I'll let you know, in Kansas, okay? But some people look down on different states like they do. You know, people have looked down on Kentucky for a long time. Had a friend, my best friend, for many years, till he got killed in a car wreck, about the time the apostasy took place. Grew up in Kentucky and talked about how that they had one other state at that time that was noted to have a worse level of education in the sense of what was being taught in the schools, and they carried that for many years. I don't believe they have that anymore, but, and I won't mention the other state, but basically it was thank God for that other state type of thing. That's how people down in that part of Kentucky used to talk and talk about there was one other state, at least, that was a little farther down the ladder than what they were. But people tend to judge things that way. Isn't that crazy? I'll tell you what. Even here, even in this region, there is a difference in attitude sometimes in the way people talk about if you're on the north side of this river or the south side of it. You know, the prejudice of human beings just bowls me over sometimes of how people will look down upon somebody. Oh, you live over there. You know, and anyway, I'll probably get in trouble for this one. You know, the regions of the South, the people tend to be more friendly, more open, and it's one of the reasons we wanted to live down there again, is because it's not too deep in the South where it becomes, anyway. I'm getting in trouble everywhere. But you can be in a store there and people will talk to you. You can be in a checkout and people will start talking to you. Now, I find a difference, candidly, on this side of the river. I'm serious. Now, some of you are shaking your head, no. But I feel that. And I'm not from this region. So anyway, we enjoy it. I love Kentucky. That's why we're living there. Anyway. But it is a good thing when people are able to be friendly to one another in communities and so forth, and neighbors are able to be friendly with each other, because the world has lost a lot of that. And the farther north you go, when we lived in Pennsylvania, it wasn't like that. It's more the, boy, I'm really getting in trouble today. Man. It's more of the New York thing where there are so many large populations of people. And, you know, when people are crammed together, there's something that happens. And there's also different kinds of people that have migrated to different regions who come from different backgrounds and of Europe and so forth. And so there are different kinds. I'm going to have to stop. Anyway. But there's a big difference in people. There truly is in this world, and how people judge and so forth. And it certainly was happening at the time of Christ, and how there were prejudices and so forth about different areas. If you're from Jerusalem, it's one thing. If you're in an area closer to it, but if you're up in Galilee, you were looked down upon. If you're a fisherman, you're looked down upon. If you're a tax collector, you're looked down upon. And so Jesus Christ went out and got different ones who went with him, who were from different backgrounds, who were basically looked down upon. They truly were. You know, amazing. You judge according to the flesh. Verse 15, I judge no one according to the flesh. That's what the context is here. By appearance. We're not supposed to judge that way. You're from so-and-so. You're from what area? And judge you accordingly. Or how much education did you receive? Or what kind of a job do you have? And I'm so sick of this garbage in the world of how people judge each other by appearance and look down their noses at others. It's a sick world out there. It truly is. You judge according to the flesh. I judge no one according to the flesh, in other words. And yet, if I judge, my judgment is true. That's what Christ is saying. If I judge, it's going to be true, for I am not alone, but I am the Father who sent me. You know, if you seek to do things the right way, even everyone within the ministry, in every situation that comes around you, to put yourself to that test, because it's something that is needed throughout the church, but I find it within the ministry as well, then in things you judge, my point being there, if it has to be judged there and looked upon in people's lives there, then indeed it needs to be looked at throughout the rest of the church in a very powerful way, that we need to be careful how we judge, that we don't judge by the way things appear to us, and make certain that we strive to judge the way God tells us to in matters, according to His Word, according to what is right and wrong before Him, not the way we feel about it, but truly seeking His help. And you know what you have to do in those cases? Pray to God. Say, Father, I don't know the answer here. You have to help me. I want to know, because you've given it by your Holy Spirit to reveal what is the right judgment here. Anyway. And yet if I judge, my judgment is true, for I am not alone, for I am with the Father who sent me. In other words, he knows that God dwells with him and within him, and he looks to God for what is right and righteous. It is also written in your law that the testimony of two men is true. I am one who bears witness of myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness of me. That's why I love the way the books were written. I was given great peace, especially in writing the second book, that it wasn't a matter of having to go to try to prove, as tendency had at times been, because of a different purpose and a different age of things that have been written in times past in the church, but to just tell it what it is. Not trying, because you can't prove things to people, no matter what you say. And so you just tell what is true, what is there, and the message that God wants to be there. And either they'll receive it or they won't. And in time, they'll either receive it or they won't. And that will determine what happens to them in time. Amazing. And so he says, I am the Father who bears witness. I am one who bears witness of myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness of me. Then they said to him, where is your Father? Why two witnesses? Why two? As far as God is concerned, with each other all the time, to bear witness of each other and what they believe and what they live and what they're at the forefront of at the end. It's for this very reason. That's why there are two that are so close, because of God's purpose. Then they said to him, where is your Father? And Jesus answered, you know neither me nor my Father. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. And these words spoke Jesus in the treasury as he taught in the temple, and no one laid hands on him, for his time was not yet come. So again, I marvel at the things he went through. I truly do. You go back and read some of these things, and you think, it's easier to understand, indeed, and grasp human beings who reject for 4,000 years everything the prophets have said, everything since the time of Christ, all of God's ministry, the apostles and different ones that God has called. But to reject the Son of God, to reject the Messiah, to reject the one that if you looked at what he was doing and what he was saying, who could but deny? But they did deny. Awesome. A witness of that period of time, 2,000 years ago. Powerful. With that, we'll stop here today and continue on next Sabbath from here.